he said.
Chapter 30. On a cold day in early October, Samson and I made the 6-hour trip by car back to Central Prison in Raleigh. We talked very little on the ride down. The clock had run out on Ellis Cooper. 2 days earlier, Cooper had been officially informed of his execution date by North Carolina's Department of Correction. Then he had been moved to the prison's death watch area. Things were proceeding in an orderly and deadly fashion. Samson and I had been authorized by the Division of Prisons to visit Sergeant Cooper. When we arrived at Central Prison, about a dozen protesters were out in the parking areas. Most were women, and they were singing gentle folk songs that harkened back to the 60s or even earlier. 3 or 4 held up signs condemning capital punishment. We hurried inside the prison and could still hear the mournful hymns beyond the heavy stone and mortar walls. The death watch area at Central had 4 cells lined up side by side and opened to a day room with a TV and shower. Ellis Cooper was the only prisoner on death watch at that time. 2 corrections officers were stationed outside his cell 24 hours a day. They were respectful and courteous when we arrived. Ellis Cooper looked up as we entered the area and seemed glad to see us. He smiled and raised his hand in greeting. "Hello, Ellis," Samson said in a quiet voice as we took chairs outside the cell. "Well, we're back. Empty-handed, but we're back." Cooper sat on a small stool on the other side of the bars. The legs of the stool were screwed into the floor. The cell itself was immaculately clean and was sparsely furnished with a bed, sink, toilet, and a wall-mounted writing table. The scene was depressing and desperate.
"Thank you for coming, John and Alex. Thanks for everything you've done for me."
"Tried to do," said Samson.
"Tried and failed. Fucked up is all we did."
Cooper shook his head.
"Just wasn't in the cards this time. Deck was stacked against us. Not your fault. Not anybody's," he muttered. "Anyway, it's good to see the two of you. I was praying you'd come." "Yeah, I'm praying now."
Samson and I knew that vigorous legal efforts were still proceeding to try to stop the execution, but there didn't seem much reason to talk about them. Not unless Cooper chose to bring the matter up, and he didn't. He seemed strangely at peace to me, the most relaxed I'd seen him. His salt and pepper hair was cut short, and his prison coveralls were neat and looked freshly pressed. He smiled again.
"Like a nice hotel in here, you know? Luxury hotel. 4 stars, 5 diamonds, whatever signifies the finest. These 2 gentlemen take good care of me. Best I could expect under the circumstances. They think I'm guilty of the 3 murders, but they're pleasant, all the same."
Then Cooper leaned into the steel bars and got as close as he could to Samson.
"This is important for me to say, John. I know you did your best, and I hope you know that too. But like I said, the deck against me was stacked so goddamn high. I don't know who wanted me to die, but somebody sure did."
He looked directly at Samson.
"John, I have no reason in the world to lie to you. Not now. Not here on Death Watch. I didn't murder those women."
Chapter 31. 24 hours earlier, Samson and I had signed an agreement to be searched before we entered the execution room. Now, at 1 o'clock in the morning, 16 men and 3 women were led into the small viewing room inside the prison. One of the men was General Stephen Bowen from Bragg. He'd kept his promise to be there, the U.S. Army's only representative. At 1:20 in the morning, the black drapes to the execution chamber were opened for the witnesses. I didn't want to be there. I didn't need to see another execution to know how I felt about them. On the order of the prison warden, the lethal injection executioner approached Cooper. I heard Samson suck in a breath beside me. I couldn't imagine what it would be like for him to watch his friend die like that. The movement of the technician seemed to startle Ellis Cooper. He turned his head and looked into the viewing room for the first time. The warden asked him if he'd like to make a statement. Cooper's eyes found us, and he held contact. The eye contact was incredibly powerful, as if he were about to lose us as he fell into the deepest chasm. Then Ellis Cooper spoke. His voice was reedy at first, but it got stronger.
I did not murder Tanya Jackson, Barbara Green, or Maureen Bruno. I would say so if I did. Take this final injection like the man I was trained to be. I didn't kill the three women outside Fort Bragg. Someone else did. God bless you all. Thank you, John and Alex. I forgive the United States Army, which has been a good father to me.
Ellis Cooper held his head up, proudly, like a soldier on parade. The executioner stepped forward. He injected a dose of Pavulon, which is a total muscle relaxer, and would stop Cooper's breathing. Very soon, Ellis Cooper's heart, lungs, and brain stopped functioning. Sergeant Cooper was pronounced dead by the warden of Central Prison at 1:31 a.m. Samson turned to me when it was over.
We just watched a murder, he said. Someone murdered Ellis Cooper, and they got away with it.
Part 2. Jamila. Chapter 32. I was early to meet the flight coming into Gate 74 at Reagan National, and once I was at the airport, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was definitely nervous. Good nervous, with anticipation. Jamila Hughes was coming to visit. The airport was crowded at about 4 on a Friday afternoon. Lots of weary, edgy business people sitting around ending their work weeks on the computer or already off the clock at the bar, or reading magazines and popular novels that ranged from Jonathan Franzen to Nora Roberts to Stephen King. I sat down, then popped up again. Finally, I walked close to the large, expansive windows and watched a big American jet slowly taxi to the gate. Well, here we go. Am I ready? Is she? Jamila was in the second wave of passengers getting off the plane. She had on jeans, a mauve top, a black leather car jacket that I remembered from our stakeouts together in New Orleans. The two of us had become fast friends on a bizarre homicide case that had started in her hometown of San Francisco, weaved its way through the South, including the Big Easy, then ended up on the West Coast again. We had been talking about seeing each other ever since, and now we were actually doing it. It was pretty courageous on both of our parts. I just hoped it wasn't dumb. I didn't think so, and I hoped Jam felt the same way. Jesus, I was twitching as she came walking up to me. She looked great, though. Nice, big smile. What was I so worried about? Where are the thick white clouds that are supposed to be covering the city as my plane approached? God, I could see everything. The White House, Lincoln Memorial, the Potomac? Jamila said, grinning. I leaned in and gave her a kiss. Not every city has mountains of fog like San Francisco. You need to travel more. Your flight okay? Sucked. Jamila grinned again. I don't like flying much these days, but I'm glad to be here. This is good, Alex. You're almost as nervous as I am. We never had trouble talking on stakeouts. We'll be fine. We'll be just fine. Now calm down so I can calm down. Deal? She grabbed me in both arms, hugged me, then kissed me lightly, but nicely, on the lips. That's much better, she said, and smacked her lips. You taste good. You must like spearmint. No, I like you. We were a whole lot more comfortable during the ride into Washington in my old Porsche. We talked about everything that had been happening since we'd last seen each other. At first, it was work stuff, but then we got into the whole terrorist mess, then how my family was, and hers, and as usual, neither of us shut up once we got started, which I love. It was only as I pulled up to the house that things began to feel tense for me again. You ready for this? I asked, before we got out of the car. Jamila rolled her eyes. Alex, I have 4 sisters and 3 brothers back in Oakland. Are you ready for that? Bring them on, I said, as I grabbed hold of her black leather duffel bag, which felt as if it held a bowling ball, and headed toward the house. I was holding my breath, but I was definitely glad that she was here. I hadn't been this excited in a long time. I missed you, I said.
Yeah, me too, said Jam.
Chapter 33. Obviously, Nana had been thinking about the appropriate welcoming dinner for a while. Jamila offered to help, and of course Nana refused to let her so much as lift a little finger. So Jam trailed her into the kitchen anyway. The rest of us followed to see what would happen next. 2 immovable forces? This was high drama. Well, all right then, all right, Nana complained some, but I could tell she was pleased by the company. It allowed her to show off her wares, put us all to work, and test Jamila at her leisure. She even managed to hum a little of Lift Every Voice and Sing while she worked. And then, so did Jamila. You okay with pork chops and apple gravy, squash casserole, over-creamed potatoes? And you're not allergic to a little cornbread, are you? Or fresh peach cobbler and ice cream? Nana asked several loaded questions at once. Love the pork chops, potatoes, peach cobbler, Jamila said as she examined the food. Neutral on squash casserole. I make creamed corn bread at home. My grandma from Sacramento's recipe. You add creamed corn, which makes it extra moist. Sometimes I throw in pork rinds, too. Nana said. That sounds pretty good, girl. I'll have to try it. If it ain't broke, Janny decided to contribute. Keep your small mind open, said Nana, wagging a crooked pinky finger at Janny. That's if you ever want it to grow bigger and don't want to remain a small person all your life. I was just defending your cornbread, Nana, said Janny. Nana winked. I can take care of myself. Dinner was served in the dining room with Usher, Yolanda Adams, and Etta James on the CD player. So far, this was pretty good. Just what the doctor ordered. We eat like this every night, Damon said. Sometimes we even have breakfast out here in the formal dining room, he told Jamila. I could tell that he already had a little crush on her. Hard not to, I suppose. Of course you do. Like when the president stops over for tea, Jamila said, and winked at Damon, then at Janny. He comes here often, Damon said, nodding. How did you know? My dad tell you? Think I saw it on CNN. We get that on the West Coast, you know. We all have TVs out by our hot tubs. Dinner and the small talk were a success. At least I thought so. The laughter was constant and mostly relaxed. Little Alex sat in his high chair, grinning the whole time. At one point, Jamila pulled Damon out of his seat, and they danced a few steps to Aretha's Who's Zoomin' Who on the CD player. Nana finally rose from the table and proclaimed, I absolutely forbid you to help with the dishes, Jamila. Alex can pitch in. That's his job. Come on, then, Jamila said to Janny and Damon. Let's go out front and trade gossip about your daddy. And your Nana, too. You have questions? I have questions. Let's dish. You too, little man, she said to Alex Jr. You're excused from kitchen detail. I followed Nana out to the kitchen with about half of the dirty dinnerware stacked in my hands and arms. She's pleasant, Nana said before we got there. She's certainly full of life. Then she started to cackle like one of those pesky crows in the old-time cartoons. What's so funny, old woman? I asked. You're really getting a big kick out of yourself, aren't you? I am. Why wouldn't I? You're just dying on the vine to know what I think. Well, surprise, surprise. She's a real sweetheart. I'll give you that, Alex. You pick nice girlfriends. She's a good one. No pressure, I warned her as I set dirty dishes in the sink and turned on the hot water. Why would I do that? I've learned my lesson with you. Then Nana started to laugh again. She seemed like her old self again. She'd gotten a clean bill of health from her doctor, or so she said. I went back to the dining room to clear away the rest of the dishes, but I couldn't resist taking a quick peek out the front window to check on Jamila and the kids. They were out in the street, tossing around Damon's football. The three of them were laughing. I also noticed that Jamila had a real good arm, through a tight spiral. She was used to playing with the boys, wasn't she? Chapter 34. Jamila was staying in the bedroom at the top of the stairs, the room we always kept for special guests. Presidents, queens, prime ministers and the like. The kids thought we were doing it for appearances, and we would have. But the unvarnished truth was, Jam and I had never been together that way. Had never even kissed before the airport reunion. Jamila was here to find out if things should go any further between the two of us. She came in through the back door of the kitchen while I was finishing up the dishes. The kids were still playing outside, and Nana was straightening up God knows what upstairs. Probably the guest room, but maybe the hall bathroom. Or the linen closet.
I can't stand it, I finally said.
What? She asked.
What's wrong?
You really want to know?
Of course I do. We're buddies, right?
I didn't answer, but I grabbed hold of Jamila's shoulders and kissed her on the mouth. Then I kissed her again. I was keeping an eye peeled for the kids. And Nana, of course. And Rosie, our cat, who was a big gossip, too. Jamila started to laugh.
They all think we're doing a lot worse than this. The kids, your grandmother, even that nosy cat.
Thinking is different from knowing, I said.
I like your family a lot,
Jamila said as she stared into my eyes.
I even like the cat. Hiya there, Rosie. You gonna tell everybody about our kisses?
I like you, I said as I held Jamila in my arms.
A lot?
She asked as she pulled away.
You better like me a lot after I came all the way here from San Francisco. God, I hate plane rides these days.
Maybe I do like you a lot. I don't see you saying too much. Not a lot of reciprocation going on here. She grabbed me again and kissed me harder. She pressed into me and then Jamila slid her tongue into my mouth. I liked that. A lot. I was starting to respond in kind, which probably wasn't a fantastic idea in the kitchen.
Get a room, said a voice behind us.
Nana was there, but she was laughing.
Let me call in the kids. I want them to see this too, she said. Let me get my Instamatic camera.
She's fooling with us, I told Jam.
I know, she said. Heck, I am, said Nana. I'm rooting for Alex to get to third base.
She was cackling like a cartoon crow again. Chapter 35. I woke up alone in bed the next morning with the sheets thrown every which way around my body. I was kind of used to the feeling, but I didn't like it any more than I ever had, especially with Jamila sleeping just down the hallway in the spare bedroom. I lay in bed for a few minutes thinking about other people who wake up feeling alone, even though some of them share a bed with somebody else. I finally slid into some loose-fitting clothes, then tiptoed down the hall to check on Jamila. I tapped lightly on the door.
I'm awake.
Come in, I heard her say. It was a nice sound, her voice. Musical, sweet. I pushed against the door and it opened with a soft whine.
Morning, Alex. I slept great, Jamila said.
She was sitting up in bed wearing a white t-shirt with SFPD in black printed on it. She started to laugh.
Sexy, huh?
Actually, yeah. Detectives can be sexy. Samuel L. Jackson in Shaft, Pam Grier in Foxy Brown. Jamila Hughes in the guest bedroom. She whispered,
come over here, you. Just for a minute. Come here, Alex.
That's an order.
I went forward and Jamila reached out her arms and I slid into them as though I belonged there. Kind of nice. Where were you when I needed you last night? I asked her.
I was right here in the guest room.
She smiled and winked.
Listen, I don't want your kids to get the wrong idea either, but...
I cocked an eyebrow.
But?
I asked.
But what?
Just but. I'll leave the rest up to you. As we were finishing breakfast, in the kitchen, without the cloth napkins, I told Nana and the kids that Jamila and I were going to tour Washington for the rest of the day. We needed a little time to ourselves. The kids just nodded over their cereal bowls. They'd been expecting as much.
I won't expect you two home for supper then, Nana said. Is that right?
That's right, I said. We'll catch a meal in town.
Mm-hmm,
Nana said.
Mm-hmm,
said the kids. I drove about 4 miles from the house on Fifth. I pulled up to 2020 O Street and stopped the car. Some people might have trouble finding the place, or even any information about the mansion on O Street. There's no sign hanging outside, no indication that it isn't a private residence. Most guests come to the mansion by word of mouth. I happen to know the owner through friends at Kincaid's restaurant in Foggy Bottom. Jamila and I went inside, where I registered, and then we were brought upstairs to the log cabin room. Along the way, just about every surface, corner, cranny, and crevice was filled with antique puppets, lithographs, jewelry, and glass cases. We took it all in, silently. A strange thing happened to me on our way upstairs. I had the thought, here I go again. It almost caused me to stop walking and head back to the car. But something inside told me not to give up, not to shut feelings out, to put my trust in Jamila. Neither of us said a word until the bellman was gone.
Chapter 36.
Wow, I could get used to this in a hurry,
Jamila whispered when we were alone in the room.
Let's explore this place. It's beautiful. Perfect, Alex. Almost too nice.
And so we explored. The log cabin room was an amazing 2 stories that even included a sauna jacuzzi. The loft was reached by spiral stairs and had a full kitchen. The walls and floors were wood paneled to suggest the simply hewn tongue and groove design of a cabin. A rough-cut stone-framed fireplace was there to keep everything cozy. There was also an aquarium. Jamila did a quick, gleeful dance. She obviously approved, and so did I, mainly because she was happy. It sure was a whole lot better than the front seats of cars where we'd spent so many hours together during surveillance details in New Orleans. As we checked out the suite, we were exploring each other a little, too. We stopped to kiss, and I discovered once again that Jamila had the sweetest tasting mouth. We held each other and danced in place a bit. We kissed some more, and my head began to feel light. I was still nervous, and I couldn't quite figure out why. Jamila slowly unbuttoned my denim shirt, and I helped her loosen and then slip out of a cream-colored silk blouse. Under her shirt, she wore a plain, thin silver chain. Very simple and lovely. Her hands gently unfastened my belt, then loosened my pants. I helped her out of her leather ones.
Such a gentleman, she said.
Somewhere along the way, I kicked off my shoes, and she did the same with her sandals. Which finally, somehow, brought the two of us to the centerpiece of the suite, a king-size bed.
I like this,
she whispered against my cheek.
Nicest bed I ever saw.
The bed was definitely the visual focus of the room. It had 4 wooden columns suggesting a canopy bed, but without the frills. It was covered with a flannelly comforter and 6 throw pillows, which we immediately tossed onto the floor. The room looked even better, a little messed up.
Music?
Jamila asked. Be nice, I said. You pick something. She switched on the CD player and found WPFW 89.3. Nina Simone's Wild as the Wind was playing. Our song. From now on, she said. Jamila and I kissed again, and her mouth was soft. I was happy to see that the homicide inspector had a gentle side. Her lips continued to press into mine, and I felt myself melting. Maybe that was why I was afraid. Here I go again. I never hurt you, she whispered, as if she knew my thoughts. You don't have to be afraid. Just don't hurt me, Alex. I won't. A few minutes later, we were dancing to Just the Two of Us, and I folded Jam in real close. This was good. She was strong, but she knew how to be tender. Another detective. How about that? We moved well together. My lips brushed the top of her shoulders, then the hollow in her throat, and just lingered. Bite me there. Just a little, she whispered. I nipped her gently, slowly. I didn't want to hurry any of this. The first time with someone wasn't like any other. Not always the best, though sometimes, but always different, exciting, mysterious. Jamila reminded me of my dead wife, Maria, and I thought that that was a good thing. She was tough on the outside, a city girl, but she could be tender and sweet. The contrast was special and dramatic enough to give me goosebumps. I could feel her breasts touch my chest. Then her whole body was pressing into me. Our kisses became deeper and more passionate and lasted longer. I undid her bra and it slipped to the floor. Then I slid off her panties and she pulled down my shorts. We stood there and looked at each other for a long time, appraising, admiring, I guess, building up anticipation and passion and whatever else was going on between us. I wanted Jamila badly now, but I waited. We waited. Disappointed? She whispered so low that I almost couldn't hear what she said. Her question threw me a little. God, no. Why should I be? Who could be disappointed with you? She didn't say anything, but I thought I knew who she was talking about. Her ex-husband had said things that had hurt her. I pulled Jamila to me and her body felt hot all over. She was trembling. We slid down on the bed and she rolled on top of me. She kissed my cheeks, then my lips. You sure you're not disappointed? Definitely not disappointed, I said. You're beautiful, Jamila. In your eyes. Okay. In my eyes, you're beautiful. I raised my head to her breasts and she lowered herself to me. I kissed one, then the other. Playing no favorites. Her breasts were small, just right. In my eyes. I continued to be amazed that Jamila didn't seem to know that she was attractive. I knew it was a terrible thing that happened to some women and some men, too. I lay my head down and looked at her face, studied it some. I kissed her nose, her cheeks. She was smiling in a way I'd never seen before. Open and relaxed. Beginning to trust, which I loved to see. I felt that I could stare into her deep brown eyes forever. I eased myself inside Jamila, and I had a thought that this was just about perfect. I had been right to trust her. Then I had another thought that I hated. What will spoil it this time? Chapter 37. Jamila started to laugh, and then she said, Phew! She ran her hand over her forehead. What's phew? I asked her. Don't tell me you're tuckered out. You look in a lot better shape than that.
Phew, I was worried about the two of us being together, and now I'm not worried. Phew, sometimes men are really self-centered or rough in bed, or it just feels all wrong.
I smiled at her. Slept with a lot of men, huh? Jamila made a little face. Cute.
I'm 36 years old. I was married for 4 years, engaged another time. I date some. Not too much lately, but some. How about you? Was I your first?
Why?
Did it seem like it? Answer the question, smart guy.
I was married once, too, I finally said. Jamila lightly punched my shoulder. Then she rolled over on top of me.
I'm really glad I came to Washington. Took a little nerve on my part. I was definitely scared.
Oh, Inspector Jamila Hughes was scared.
Well, so was I admitted. How come? What scared you about me, Alex?
Some women are so self-centered, or rough in bed.
Jamila leaned over and kissed me, probably to shut me up. Her lips were soft and sweet. We kissed, a long, lingering one. I was ready again, and so was she. Jamila pulled me close, and I moved inside her. This time I was on top. I am your love slave. Completely submissive, she whispered against my cheek. I'm definitely glad I came to Washington.
Our second time together was even better than the first, and also edged out the third time.
No, there had been nothing for either of us to be afraid of.
Jamila and I stayed at the hotel through the afternoon and into the early evening. It was almost impossible to leave.
As it had been right from the start with the two of us, we found it easy to talk about anything on the planet. I'll tell you something really strange, she said. And the more I'm with you, the stranger this seems to me. See, my first husband and I could never really talk. Not the way you and I do. And we still got married. I don't know what I was thinking.
A little while later, Jamila got up and disappeared into the bathroom. I saw the light flash on the telephone on the nightstand. She was making a call.
Once a detective? Oh boy, here we go.
When she came out, she confessed. I had to call work.
Murder case I'm on out there is a mess. Nasty stuff. Sorry. Won't happen again, I promise. I'll be good. Or bad. Whatever you want me to be.
No, it's fine. I understand, I said. I did, of course. Sort of, anyway. I saw so much of myself in Jamila. The detective. I think that was a good thing. I hugged her and held her close once she got back into bed. Then the truth finally came out. It was my turn to confess.
Long time ago, I told her.
I was at this hotel with my wife.
Jamila pulled back a little. She looked deeply into my eyes. That's okay, she said. Doesn't mean anything, except I really love that you were guilty about it. That's nice. I'll always remember that about my trip to Washington.
Your first trip, I said.
My first trip.
Jamila agreed.
Chapter 38.
Our time together in Washington raced by like a couple of blinks of an eye, and before I knew it, Jamila had to go back to San Francisco. Sunday afternoon at a very crowded Reagan National. Fortunately, my badge got me out to the gate area. I was bummed to see her leave, and I didn't think she wanted to go, actually. The two of us hugged for a long time at the gate and didn't much care if anyone was staring. Then Jam had to run to her plane. Or miss it.
Why don't you just stay another night?
I asked. Lots of planes tomorrow. And the next day. Day after that.
I really, really like this, she said as she pulled away from me and started to backpedal. Bye, Alex. Please miss me. I liked Washington more than I thought I would.
A flight attendant followed her in and closed the door between us.
Jeez.
I even liked the way Jamila ran.
She glided.
And I did miss her already. I was starting to fall again, and that scared me. That night at home, I was up long after midnight. At one particularly low point, I went out to the sun porch and sat at the piano, playing a pretty pathetic "Someone to Watch Over Me"
thinking about Jamila Hughes, romanticizing like hell, loving every painful second of it. I wondered what was going to happen to the two of us. Then I remembered something Samson had once said. Don't ever be Alex's girlfriend. It's dangerous. Unfortunately, he had been right so far. A few minutes later, I became aware of banging on the screen door out front. I went around and found Samson leaning against the door jamb. He didn't look real good. Actually, he looked awful.
Chapter 39.
He was unshaved, his clothes wrinkled, his eyes red and swollen. I had the feeling he'd been drinking. Then I opened the door and smelled liquor all over him as if he'd taken a bath in the stuff.
Figured you'd be up, he slurred out a few words. Knew you would be.
Yeah, he'd been drinking. A lot. I hadn't seen John like this in a long time, maybe ever. He didn't look real happy either. Come on inside, I said. Come on, John.
Don't need to go anywhere,
he said loudly.
Don't need any more help from you. You helped enough, man.
What the hell is wrong with you, I said, and tried again to guide him inside the house. He shook loose, his long, powerful arms flailing.
What did I say? I don't need your help, he yelled at me. You already fucked up enough. The great Dr. Cross, yeah, right. Not this time. Not for Ellis Cooper.
I took a step back away from him. Keep your voice down. Everybody's sleeping inside, you hear me?
Don't tell me what the hell to do. Don't you fucking dare,
he snarled.
You fucked up. We fucked up, but you're supposed to be so smart.
I finally told Samson, go home and sleep it off. I shut the door on him. But he pulled it open again. Almost took the damn thing off its hinges.
Don't walk away from me either, he yelled.
Then he shoved me hard. I let it go. But Samson pushed again. That was when I lunged at him. I'd had enough of his drunken shit. The two of us tumbled down the wooden steps and onto the lawn. We wrestled on the ground and then he tried to throw a punch. I blocked it. Thank God he was too messed up to throw a straight punch.
You fucked up, Alex. You let Cooper die,
he yelled in my face as we both struggled to our feet. I refused to hit him, but he struck out at me again. The punch connected with my cheek. I went down as if I didn't have any legs. I sat there, stunned, my eyes glazing over. Samson pulled me up, and by this time he was gasping and wheezing. He tried for a headlock. Christ, he was strong. He connected with a short, hard punch to the side of my face. I went down again, but struggled back up. We were both groaning. I heard where he'd hit me on the point of my cheekbone. He threw a roundhouse punch that missed by an inch. Then a hard blow caught my shoulder and made it ache. I warned myself to stay away from him. He had me by 4 inches and 40 pounds. He was drunk, angry, insane as I'd ever seen him. He wouldn't stop coming at me. Samson was filled with rage. I had to take him down if I could, somehow. But how? I finally hit him with an uppercut to the stomach. I jabbed his cheek, drew blood. Then I fired a short right hand into his jaw. That one had to hurt.
Stop it! Stop it right now! Both of you, stop!
I heard the voice ringing in my ear.
Alex! John! Stop this disgraceful behavior! Stop it, you two! Just stop it!
Nana was pulling the two of us apart. She was wedged in between us like a small but determined referee. She'd done it before, but not since we were 12 years old. Samson straightened up and looked down at Nana.
Sorry, he mumbled. I'm sorry, Nana.
He looked ashamed. Then he stumbled away without saying a word to me.
Chapter 40.
I went down to breakfast the next morning a little before 6. Samson was sitting there, eating eggs and his personal favorite, farina. Nana Mama was across from him at the table. Just like old times. They were talking quietly as if sharing a deep secret that no one else should know. Am I interrupting? I asked from the doorway. I think we have it sorted out now, Nana said. She motioned for me to sit at the breakfast table. I poured coffee first, popped in 4 slices of whole wheat toast, and then finally sat down with Nana and Samson. He had a big glass of milk propped in front of him. I couldn't help remembering back to when we were kids. 2 or 3 mornings a week he'd show up about this time to break bread with Nana and me. Where else could he go? His parents were junkies. In a way, Nana had always been like a mother or grandmother to him, too. He and I had been like brothers since we were 10. That's why the fight the night before was so disturbing.
Let me talk, Nana, he said.
She nodded and sipped her tea. I'm pretty sure why I chose psychology for a career and who my original role model was. Nana has always been the best shrink I've seen. She's wise and compassionate for the most part, but tough enough to insist on the truth. She also knows how to listen.
I'm sorry, Alex. I didn't sleep last night. I feel awful about what happened. I was way over the line, Samson said.
He was staring into my eyes, forcing himself not to look away. Nana watched the two of us as if we were Cain and Abel sitting at her breakfast table. You were over the line, all right, I said. That's for sure. You were also crazy last night. How much did you drink before you came over? John told you he was sorry, Nana said.
Nana,
he turned to her, then back to me.
Ellis Cooper was like a brother to me. I can't get over the execution, Alex. In a way, I'm sorry I went to see it. He didn't kill those women. I thought we could save him, so it's my fault. I expected too much.
He stopped talking. So did I said. I'm sorry we failed. Let me show you something. Come upstairs. This is about payback now. There's nothing left but payback. I brought Samson to my office in the attic of the house. I had notes on army murder cases pinned all over the walls. The room looked like the hideout of a madman, one of my obsessive killers. I took him to my desk. I've been working on these notes since I met Ellis Cooper. I found 2 more of these remarkable cases. One in New Jersey, the other in Arizona. The bodies were painted, John. I took Samson through the cases, sharing everything. Along the way, I told him, I learned that the Pentagon has been working to prevent over 1,000 deaths the peacetime military suffers every year from high-speed car crashes, suicides, and murders. Still, during the past year, more than 60 soldiers have been murdered.
60? Samson said and shook his head. 60 murders a year?
Most of the violence has to do with sex and hate crimes, I said. Rapes and murders. Homosexuals who've been beaten or killed. A series of vicious rapes by an army sergeant in Kosovo. He didn't think he'd get caught because there was so much rape and killing going on there anyway.
Were any other bodies painted?
He wanted to know. I shook my head. Just the 2 cases I found, New Jersey and Arizona. But that's enough. It's a pattern.
So what do we really have?
Samson shook his head and looked at me. I don't know yet. It's hard to get information out of the army. Something very nasty going on. It looks like soldiers may have been framed for murder. The first was in New Jersey. The latest seems to be Ellis Cooper. There are definite similarities, John. Murder weapons found a little too conveniently. Fingerprints and DNA used to convict. All of these men had good service records. In the Arizona murder case transcripts, there was a mention of 2 or 3 men seen near the victim's house before the homicide took place. There's a possibility that innocent men have been framed and then wrongfully put to death. Framed, then wrongfully executed. And I know something else, I said.
What's that?
These killers aren't brilliant like Gary Sinise or Kyle Craig, but they're every bit as deadly. They're expert at what they do, and what they do is kill and get away with it. Samson frowned and shook his head.
Not anymore.
Chapter 41.
Thomas Starkey had been born in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and he still loved the area passionately. So did most of his neighbors. He'd been away for long stretches while he was in the Army, but now he was back to stay and to raise his family as best he possibly could. He knew that Rocky Mount was a great place to bring up kids. Hell, he'd been brought up here, hadn't he? Starkey was devoted to his family, and he also genuinely liked the families of his two best friends. He also needed to control everything around him. Just about every Saturday night, Starkey got the three clans together and barbecued. The exception was during football season when the families usually had a tailgate party on Friday night. Starkey's son Shane played tailback for the high school. North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Georgia Tech were after Shane, but Starkey wanted him to put in a tour with the Army before he attended college. That's what he had done, and it had worked out for the best. It would work for Shane, too. The three men usually did all the shopping and cooking for the Saturday night barbecues and the tailgate parties. They bought steaks, ribs, and hot and sweet sausages at the farmer's market. They selected corn on the cob, squash, tomatoes, asparagus. They even made the salads, usually German potato, coleslaw, macaroni, and occasionally Caesar. That Friday was no exception, and by 7:30 the men were in their familiar positions beside two Weber grills, staying downwind from the wafting smoke, drinking beer, cooking every meal to order. Hell, they even cleaned up and did the dishes. They were proud to deliver the food just right and to get pretty much the same kind of applause given to their sons on football nights. Starkey's number two, Brownlee Harris, tended to intellectualize. He'd attended Wake Forest and then gone to grad school at UNC. "The irony is pretty thick here, don't you think?" he asked as he gazed at the family scene. "Fuck all, Brownie. You'd see irony in a turkey shooter and a clusterfuck in a rice paddy. You think too goddamn much," Warren Griffin said and rolled his eyes. "That's your problem in life." "Maybe you just don't think enough," Harris said, then winked at Starkey, whom he considered a god. "We're going off to kill somebody this weekend, and here we are calmly barbecuing sirloin steaks for our families. You don't think that's a little strange?"
"I think you're fucking strange is what I think. We got a job to do, so we do it, no different from the way it was for a dozen years in the big army. We did a job in Vietnam, in the Persian Gulf, Panama, Rwanda. It's a job. Of course, I happen to love my job. Might be some irony in that. I'm a family man and a professional killer, so what of it? Shit happens. It surely does. Blame the U.S. Army, not me."
Starkey nodded his head toward the house, a two-story with five bedrooms and two baths he'd built in 1999. "Girls are coming," he said. "Put a lid on it." "Hey, beautiful," he called, then gave his wife Judy a big hug. Judy Blue Eyes was a tall, attractive brunette who still looked almost as good as she had on the day they were married. Like most of the women in town, she spoke with a pronounced southern accent and she liked to smile a lot. Judy even did volunteer work 3 days a week at the playhouse. She was funny, appreciative, a good lover, and a good life partner. Starkey believed he was lucky to have found her, and she was lucky to have chosen him. All three of the men loved their wives, up to a point. Hell, that was another juicy irony for Brownlee Harris to ponder late into the night.
"We must be doing something right," Starkey said as he held Judy in his arms and toasted the other couples.
"You sure did," Judy Blue Eyes said. "You boys married well. Who else would let their husbands sneak off for a weekend every month or so and trust that they were being good boys out there in the big bad world?"
"We're always good. Nobody does it better," Starkey said, and smiled good-naturedly at his closest friends. "It doesn't get any better than this, it really doesn't. We're the best there is."
Chapter 42.
On Saturday night, the three killers made their way north to a small town in West Virginia called Harper's Ferry. During the road trip, Brownlee Harris's job was to study maps of the AT, as the Appalachian Trail was called by many of the people who hiked it regularly. The spot where they were headed was a particularly popular place for hikers to stop. Harper's Ferry was tiny, actually. You could walk from one end of town to the other in less than 15 minutes. There was a point of interest nearby called Jefferson Rock where you could see Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia. Kind of neat. Starkey drove for the entire trip, no need for any relief. He liked to be at the wheel and in control anyway. He was also in charge of entertainment, which consisted of his Springsteen's Greatest Hits tape, a Janis Joplin, a Doors, a Jimi Hendrix anthology, and a Dale Brown audiobook. Warren Griffin spent almost the entire trip checking the team's supplies and readying the rucksacks in back. When he was finished, the packs weighed about 40 pounds, a little more than half of what they used to carry on their recon missions in Vietnam and Cambodia. He had prepared the packs for a hunt and kill, the kind of ambush Colonel Starkey had planned for the Appalachian Trail. Griffin had packed standard-issue canteens, LRPs, meals that were pronounced LRPs, hot sauce to kill the taste of the LRPs, a tin can for coffee. Each of them would have a K-bar, the standard military combat knife, camo sticks with two colors of grease paint, boonie hats, poncho liners that could do double duty as ground cover, night vision goggles, a Glock, as well as an M16 rifle fitted with a sniper scope. When he was finished with the work, Griffin uttered one of his favorite lines. "If you want to get a good belly laugh out of God, just tell him about your plans." Starkey was the TL, or team leader. He was in control of every aspect of the job. Harris was the point man. Griffin was rear security, still the junior guy after all these years. They didn't have to do the hunt and kill exactly like this. They could have made it a whole lot easier on themselves. But this was the way Starkey liked it, the way they had always committed their murders. It was the Army way.
Chapter 43.
They made camp about 2 clicks from the AT. It was dangerous for them to be seen by anybody, so Starkey established an NDP, a night defense position, for the camp. Then they each kept watch in 2-hour shifts. Nostalgia rules. When Starkey took his shift, he passed the time thinking not so much about the job looming ahead of them as the job in general. He, Harris, and Griffin were professional killers and had been for over 20 years. They'd been assassins in Vietnam, Panama, and the Gulf War. Now they were assassins for hire. They were careful, discreet, and expensive. The current job was their most lucrative and had involved several murders over a period of 2 years. The curious thing about it, they didn't know the identity of their employer. They were given new targets only after the previous job was completed. As he stared into the dark, restless woods, Starkey wanted a cigarette, but he settled for an Altoids. Those little fuckers kept you awake. He found himself thinking about the blonde bitch they had offed near Fayetteville, pretty Vanessa. The memory got him hard, which helped the time pass. While they were still in Vietnam, Starkey had discovered that he liked to kill. The murders gave him a powerful feeling of control and then elation. It was as if electricity were passing through his body. He never felt guilt, not anymore. He killed for hire, but he also killed in between jobs because he wanted to and liked it.
"Strange, scary stuff," Starkey muttered, rubbing his hands together. "Scare myself sometimes."
The three of them were up and ready by 5 the next morning, which was shrouded in a thick bluish-gray fog. The air was cool but incredibly fresh and clean. Starkey figured the fog wouldn't burn off until at least 10. Harris was in the best physical shape of the three, so he was designated as the scout. He wanted the job anyway. At 51, he still played in a men's basketball league and did triathlons twice a year. At 5:15, he set off from camp at a comfortable jogging pace. Christ, he loved this shit. Nostalgia. Harris found that he was wide awake and alert once he was on the move. He was operating beautifully after just a few minutes on the trail. The hunt and kill was a satisfying combination of business and pleasure for him, for all three of them. Harris was the only one up this early on the AT, at least on this particular stretch. He passed a 4-person dome tent, probably some white bread family. Most likely section hikers, as opposed to through hikers who would take up to 6 months to do the entire trail, finally ending at a place called Mount Katahdin, Maine. Around the dome tent, he noticed a camp stove and fuel bottles, ratty shorts and t-shirts laid out to air. Not a target, he decided and moved on. Next, he came upon a couple in sleeping bags just off the trail. They were young, probably go-see-the-world types. They slept on self-inflatable air mattresses, all the comforts of home. Harris got up close, no more than 10 yards from them, before he finally decided to move on. He could tell the girl was a looker, though. Blonde, cute face, maybe 20. Just watching her sleep with her boyfriend got his jets going pretty good. They were a definite maybe. He saw a second couple already up and exercising near their tent about a quarter mile farther on. They had high-tech internal frame packs and $200 hiking boots and looked like snooty city slicks. He liked them as potential targets, mainly because he disliked the couple so much immediately. Not far past the couple's camp, he came upon a single male hiker. This guy was definitely in for the long haul. He had a high-tech pack that looked light and tight. He would probably be carrying dried food, trail mix, protein drink powder. Fresh food was too heavy and difficult to haul around on your back all day. His wardrobe would be no frills too, nylon shorts, tank tops, maybe long underwear for the colder nights. Harris stopped and watched the single hiker's camp for a couple of minutes. He let his heartbeat slow and controlled his breathing. Finally, he slipped right into the man's camp. He wasn't afraid, and he never doubted himself. He took what he needed. The hiker never stirred from his sleep. Harris checked his sports watch and saw that it was only 5:50. So far, so good. He walked back to the trail, then began to jog again. He felt invigorated, excited about the hunt and kill out here on the nature trail. Man, he wanted to kill somebody bad. Man or woman, old or young, it didn't much matter. The next camp he came upon was close. Another couple, still asleep in a two-person dome tent. Harris couldn't help thinking how easy it would be to take them out right now. Ducks on a pond. Everybody was so vulnerable and trusting out here. What a bunch of loonies. Didn't they ever read the funny papers? There were killers on the loose in America, lots of them. A little less than a mile beyond, he reached the camp of another family. Someone was already up. He hid in the pine trees and watched. A fire had been started and was throwing up sparks. A woman of about 40 was futzing around with a rucksack. She wore a red Speedo swimsuit and seemed in good physical shape. Well-muscled arms and legs, a nice ass, too. She called out, "Wakey, wakey!" Moments later, two shapely teenage girls emerged from the larger tent. They had on one-piece bathing suits and were slapping their little bodies with their hands, trying to get warm in a hurry. Trying to wakey-wakey. Mama bear and two baby bears, Brownlee Harris muttered. Interesting concept. Maybe too close to the murders at Bragg, though. He watched as the three women huddled for a moment around the fire, then took off in a run. Soon he could hear a chorus of war whoops and screams, then laughter and loud splashes as they hit the small brook that ran directly behind their camp. Brownlee Harris moved quickly and silently through the trees until he reached a choice spot where he could watch the mother and pretty daughters frolic in the cold stream. They sure reminded him of the women in the massacre at Fayetteville. Still, they could be the secondary target. He returned to his camp at a little past 6:30. Griffin had prepared breakfast. Eggs, bacon, plenty of coffee. Starkey was sitting in a familiar lotus position, thinking and plotting. He opened his eyes before Harris announced himself. "How'd you do?" he asked. Brownlee Harris smiled. "We're right on schedule, Colonel. We're good. I'll describe the targets while we eat. Coffee smells good. Hell of a lot better than napalm in the morning."
Chapter 44
Starkey took full command that morning. Unlike the other hikers on the AT, he kept his men deep in the woods, unseen by their fellow travelers or anyone else. It wasn't hard to do. In their past lives, they'd spent days, sometimes weeks, being invisible to enemies who were out to find and kill them, but frequently ended up getting killed themselves.
One time it had been a team of 4 homicide detectives in Tampa, Florida. Starkey demanded that they treat this like a real-life combat mission in real-life war. Total silence was imperative. They used hand signals most of the time. If someone had to cough, he did so in his neck rag or in the crook of an arm. Their rucksacks had been packed tight by Sergeant Griffin so that nothing shook or rattled as they walked. The 3 of them had slathered on bug juice, then laid on the camo. They didn't smoke a cigarette all day. No mistakes.